Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dedicated design show. I'm Josh Fennett. Today we bring you the first instalment of a two-part special on the city of Oslo. The eyes of the world's architectural community are trained on the Norwegian capital as it hosts the hotly anticipated Oslo Architecture Triennale 2016. We'll take a close look at the event on next week's show. But today, we look past the lectures and exhibits of the OAT to the groundswell of design talent that's bringing Norway out of the shadows of Scandinavian design. Monocle's intrepid Henry Rees Sheridan donned a warm coat and headed to the city. Today, we listen in on his conversation with some of Oslo's best and brightest. First up,
when we function as advisors to both private and public services, the process of the service design can create tremendous improvements for the people living here.
We speak to Jan Stavik of the Norwegian Centre for Design and Architecture, that's DOGA for short. Next to the new generation of Norwegian designers. We speak to Rune Klok and Thomas Jenkins from the self-styled Norwegian Designers Union, Klubben. And we join Ketil Thorsen and Jette Hopp from Norwegian architecture design giant Snøhetta in the lobby of the monumental Oslo National Opera House to discuss the building and their vision for the city's future. Finally,
up in Stoke-on-Trent, there was a man who chained himself to a lamppost in protest against its removal. He felt so strongly about the beauty of this lamppost.
Author Eleanor Herring joins us to discuss the history of British post-war street furniture and what these unassuming items tell us about the history of the nation. All that to come right here on Section D on Monocle 24. And now over to today's host, Henry Rees Sheridan.
Norway is one of the world's wealthiest countries, and it's put that wealth to good use, investing in the extensive welfare provisions and infrastructural projects that characterise the much-lauded Nordic model of social democracy. But in comparison to its neighbours Sweden and Denmark, it's garnered less renown when it comes to design and architecture. But that's changing. The emergence of a new generation of young Norwegian designers, as well as signature architectural projects in Oslo, are turning the city and Norway into a design destination. To get an overview of Norway's design and architecture past and present, I spoke to Jan Stavik. He's from DOGA, the Norwegian Centre for Design and Architecture, which promotes the understanding, knowledge and use of design and architecture in Norway. Speaking to me in DOGA's HQ, he began with an account of how Norway and Oslo have changed over the course of his career.
Two very important things have happened if we look, for instance, at a 50-year span. First of all, up till 1960, Norway was one of the poorest countries in Europe. And that obviously has consequences for the level of sophistication of design and architecture. But after we found the oil and the country started to prosper, we also turned into a country of finished goods to a much larger extent than before, because we have been historically very much a raw material country, and that is not a very good ground for understanding of design. Fish is fish and electricity is electricity. And that's probably one of the main differences between the structure of the Scandinavian countries, is that Norway is by far, and has been and still is, ref the oil and the fish, a raw material nation. But we have obviously prospered into making finished goods and also some of them becoming international brands, and their design will always be essential. And as the rest of the Western world, we are moving very fast towards a country of services. 80% of all new jobs in Norway is in services. And that's where the service design thing becomes very important. And we see that becoming very much important for our organization. And we see that when we function as advisors to both private and public services, the process of the service design can create tremendous improvements for the people living here. That is probably the main area where the citizens of Oslo will notice that Oslo becomes better. And that is to the extent that we can improve services in the country and in the capital. On the architectural side, we're into a very, very exciting decade now. As you know, we opened the fantastic opera a few years ago, and there are four or five major, almost iconic projects coming along, like the Munch Museum, the new National Museum, the new National Library. And when all these get together, I think that the most noticeable change you will see in Oslo will be on architecture. I think that on design it will slowly be coming, but architecture is probably what you will see the first.
Let's talk about what Oslo does well and not so well in terms of the field that you've mentioned, specifically service design. How have things improved over the course of your career in the field, and what improvements are there still to be made?
I think there's a lot of improvements to be made. One of the areas that we have made some exciting progress, and maybe not too many people have noticed yet, has been in the field of health, the National Health Service, where we had some exciting projects. For instance, one of them, which has created a lot of interest, and it was even put on the OECD's list of top 10 social innovations, was that we managed through a service design project with Norway's largest hospital to reduce the waiting time for a diagnosis for breast cancer with 90%. So literally, we have through these projects saved lives of women, which I think is fantastic. But I don't expect yet that all citizens of Oslo will run around knowing that we have improved their hospitals and the health service. We've done some remarkable improvements. We had a very good project with the Oslo Hospital's emergency station, where we also reduced a very bureaucratic waiting line. People were coming there with sick children, sitting 4 hours and waiting. Introduced a very, very efficient and good system to that. We were initially doing the whole job of the profiling of both the Winter Olympics in 94 and also the Oslo Airport Express train. And that, I think, was probably one of the first big graphic design projects at that kind of level. And people of Oslo, I think, were for the first time noticing and being actually proud of a train, which was unheard of before. A train was just a rattling thing that took you from one place to another if you were lucky. So I think maybe we haven't been good enough telling about what design is actually doing in their daily lives, and that is probably going to be an interesting element of the future strategy of the new DOGA.
How conscious are you of Norway's ambitions and the need to develop a national design brand? And have you seen any steps in this direction? Some people have said to me that the Norway is the black sheep of Scandinavian design. I wonder what you think of that in relation to this.
I can understand the saying, and we've now been at part of the London Design Festival for almost 15 years in terms of an exhibition called 100% Norway. And the reactions there are definitely not the black sheep. In fact, there's been famous international designers or journalists who have said, now look to Norway. So there are exciting things happening here. And I think it would be wonderful if we could squeeze even more money out of the government. So we didn't only come once a year to London, but maybe we should go to 10 international cities for 10 years. And then there might be an image of Norway not being the black sheep, but being an exciting new industrial nation.
That was Jan Stavik of DOGA, the Norwegian Centre for Design and Architecture. Official institutions like DOGA have a critical role to play in encouraging a healthy design ecosystem in Norway and Oslo. But the vital energy for growth in the field has to come from young designers. Many of Norway's brightest design talents have banded together as Klubben. It's a union of young Norwegian designers with varied backgrounds within furniture and product design, founded in 2011 to promote their work internationally and nationally. To learn more, I joined two Oslo-based members of the group, Rune Klok and Thomas Jenkins, in their spacious studio space in the heart of Oslo.
My name is Thomas Jenkins. I'm a furniture and product designer based here in Oslo.
My name is Rune Klok, and I'm also a furniture designer. I have my studio here in Oslo, and I'm a part of Klubben.
Klubben is a group of young designers based internationally, but with some kind of attachment to Norway, be it by heritage or by where they live at the moment. And it came from a desire to sort of create more meeting points within the sort of yearly program of design events, and to promote both young design inside of Norway and externally abroad.
Yeah, we're actually in just a network, so it's kind of loose, but we're 31 designers now.
I think so.
And we cooperate to have exhibitions, and we're also a place where I think journalists and people who are interested in Norwegian design can find an easy entrance to information about Norwegian designers and what's going on. And we share contacts. We're helping each other.
And one of the things that distinguishes Klubben as a Norwegian design institution is the fact that it is geared towards younger designers, the new generation of designers. How do you think your worldview as Norwegian designers is different to that of the generation of designers and architects before you? And why is that important?
The generation that came after obviously had a lot more resources and could travel more and saw more of Europe and more of the world, which obviously has a greater impact on your cultural awareness. And I think also there was an amazing shift in the way that the industry of the people that were sub-supplying to furniture manufacturers sort of deserted them and focused totally on the oil and gas industry, because there's a greater return on investment, which is quite a natural decision to make. But this left a sort of gaping hole in the manufacturing base for sort of softer goods, softer production, furniture and accessories and product design. And everything just became so heavily geared towards the oil and gas industry and all the periphery around there.
Yeah, also I think that designers in the 50s and 60s, they were kind of part of the Scandinavian design period. So they were equal to the Danish and the Swedish designers. Whilst when we started, we didn't have that the same tradition as the Swedes and the Danes. Mm. So we were kind of starting from zero or maybe from five or whatever, but we didn't have the same tradition to build upon. So I think we were more free as well to go out.
Yeah, I think you could say that, you know, in Sweden and Denmark, there's been a sort of year-on-year stepping stone of a heritage being built up, whereas in Norway, there was sort of a gap, and the only people that sort of grabbed the public's attention were doing things that were maybe a little bit off the wall and a little bit crazy, and there wasn't this sort of refined design progress in the language of design in Norway. Whereas in Denmark and Sweden, this was happening year on year, and you'd be an apprentice in a studio or, you know, do some work experience with a generation above you, whereas we were very detached and had to sort of make our own base.
What's it like to operate on the granular level as a creative designer architect in Oslo? Is it a city which facilitates you getting to do what you want to do? Are there obstacles in place? If so, what are they?
Yeah, I think it's sort of six of one, half a dozen of the other there, because the scene is not as big as it is in London or New York. So, you get maybe more space, but there's less, a slower pulse, you could say. With regard to facilitation of designers and our work, I think that's something that's really come on, especially the interior side of the industry in the last 5 years. I'd say there's been a real escalation in restaurants and cafes and, you know, other businesses within the city using properly skilled people to manage and plan their spaces. We're still looking for a little boom in the manufacturing side of things, in the furniture and product accessory world. We're very keen to do that. And there's a lot of talk, you know, the oil honeymoon is definitely over, but Norway needs to refocus somewhat with the higher oil price now, making it quite prohibitive to pull the oil out of the North Sea at the moment. So we have to reevaluate a little bit, and hopefully there will be a better manufacturing base for us that really want to work with furniture and product design.
But I think there's a shift. There's a lot of, I think in Norway, maybe we haven't had that high self-esteem, like the production furniture factories. So going abroad for us and showing our stuff and getting kind of approved by someone from outside gives us jobs when we come back. Mm. So I think it's been a very important strategy for us to go abroad.
Rune Klok and Thomas Jenkins there from the Norwegian Young Designers Union, Klubben. We'll turn to Norway before long, but for now we take a break from the fjords and forest and turn our attention to an altogether less bucolic environment. Elna Herring is a design writer and lecturer whose most recent book looks at the politics of street furniture design in post-war Britain. The central tenet of her new book, Street Furniture Design, which is available from Bloomsbury Publishers, is that, benign as they seem, lamppost, dustbins and benches have all been a source of intense debate and power struggles in the UK. Her book explores this hidden history, and she joins our producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan, in studio to discuss it.
I think these objects are interesting for all sorts of reasons. They're kind of designed to be ignored, but at the same time designed to be seen when we need them. And that, to me, presents quite an interesting kind of tension.
The subtitle of your book is Contesting Modernism. Why are these authorless objects so politically contentious.
Up until the war and during the war, the destruction of Britain's sort of urban fabric had a huge impact upon street furniture. But there was also, throughout this period, I think, a lack of investment in street furniture, which meant that by the end of the war, there was a really big need to renew, to restore, to rejuvenate Britain's streets. And many of those who were working in quite sort of privileged design positions at the time believed that actually it was through street furniture that you could create a better Britain, a Britain that was more beautiful, more civilised, more modern. The reason I focused on this period is because this contentiousness that you mentioned before really kind of characterised this period. People had really strong opinions about lampposts, about benches and about litter bins, about these really kind of boring, otherwise quite mundane, authorless objects. Perhaps it's hard to understand why these objects became so contentious. But if you look at the street furniture before this period, kind of typically cast iron, quite decorative objects, quite traditional looking, the objects that these new bodies, these figures were advocating were wholly different. They were really modern. And this, I think, created a conversation, if we put that diplomatically, but it created huge controversies in certain parts of the country over what these objects should look like. And I think, you know, there's countless examples, particularly with lampposts. Lampposts got a lot of bad press, concrete lampposts especially. But we could look at road signs. There's parking meters, of course. Litter bins were contentious. They caused a lot of anger in communities around the country. And people, members of the public, really would try to do whatever they could, using whatever resources that they had available to them to fight this battle for better street furniture.
And give me some examples of what kind of... Are we talking about hard-nosed vandalism? Are we talking about more legitimate political kind of routes? What are you talking about?
Well, so it ranged from examples in Highgate, for example, where members of the public, one lady in particular, would write letters to various sort of people in government and also local government to stop these monstrosities from disturbing her sleep, from disturbing the harmony of the streetscape. You know, up in Stoke-on-Trent, there was a man who chained himself to a lamppost in protest against its removal. He felt so strongly about the beauty of this lamppost.
And let's be blunt about where the lines of division were drawn here. Is it an instance of basically the population, normal people who have to live on the streets where these things are put up, versus a kind of design slash governmental elite? Is that mainly the line of division, or is it more complex than that?
I think it's more complex than that. Initially, I came at it assuming that it would be quite black and white, you know, the high ups versus the low downs, something like that. But in fact, different groups fought alongside and against one another, depending upon the circumstances. There's also, and I think I try to show this in the book, there's a sense that these loyalties were constantly being tested and were shifting. And this, I think, is in some ways reflective of the overall kind of point of the book, that there was this huge kind of fragmentation happening throughout the 50s and 60s about what street furniture should look like and who should get to decide. This word that keeps coming up again and again throughout the debate is tyranny, the tyranny of those in charge. But sometimes those in charge could be the public. Sometimes they could be democratically elected local councillors. Sometimes it could be a design elite. And those in charge, it's not quite so simple. It was also questions in the 50s and 60s, especially about taste and whose taste was shaping these objects and what was their motivation. You know, we can interpret taste in lots of different ways. We can interpret taste through the prism of class, say, for instance.
Could you be more specific about kind of, give me an example of an object, perhaps, and how its design was contentious in this specific way with regards to taste and perhaps class as well?
Well, say, for example, the parking meter or the road signs that were designed by Kinnear and Calvert. There was a sense, I think, certainly in my conversations with Margaret Calvert, that good taste was something that should be fought against. Good taste had soiled so much of what was happening in the 1950s in design terms. And so these classic road signs that we still see in the streets today, they were a kind of revolt against good taste. They wanted to sit outside, or at least the designers wanted these designs to sit outside this prism of good taste, something that was, I think there's moral associations with that. You know, that idea that so many people had during this time that street furniture design should civilize the street and by kind of implication should civilize the users of those streets. So these road signs that we're all so familiar with at the time in which they were designed, those designers didn't want it to be a classic. They wanted it to be purely functional, to sit outside the realms of good taste and all of that discourse about good design that had so kind of characterised the debate after the Second World War about design.
Eleanor Herring, a design writer and lecturer there on her book Street Furniture Design, which is available now from Bloomsbury. To end the show, we head back to Oslo and here's Henry Rees-Sheridan as our guide.
Architecturally, Oslo has undergone radical change in recent years. The so-called Barcode project, a row of new, multi-purpose, high-rise buildings built on redeveloped industrial docklands, caused intense public debate, with many locals and architects feeling the buildings compromised the fundamentally low-rise character of the city. But the most important architectural project of the last decade is the city's National Opera House. A monumental building completed in 2008, it was controversial not only because of its size and cost, but also because of its symbolism. It was a signature project of Snøhetta, the transdisciplinary firm that has gone on to become Norway's preeminent design giant. I met architect Jette Hupp and founding partner Kjetil Thorsen in the lobby of the Opera House to talk about the building, Snøhetta, and the company's role in the future of Norwegian design.
My name is Jette Katrin Hupp. I'm working at the transdisciplinary architectural firm Snøhetta, located in Oslo, and I'm a project director and a project manager and work on projects on all scale and also on acquisitions and first stage of project development.
And we're sitting here in the foyer area of one of Snøhetta's most seminal projects to date, the monumental Opera House, National Opera House here in Oslo. If you could talk a little bit about its physical features and also the culture, I suppose, that it inspires and encourages.
Mm-hmm. It's actually the whole building, the whole concept is more related to nature than rather than to architecture. So then we, when you move on the roof, and we did the tour before, it's more like going on a big mountain, a glacier, and that kind of thinking relating to landscape elements is going through all the building. One can see it reflected in all the different elements. So the roof itself, we can start with the materiality. It's marble. It's the most precious and valued material that's used actually on the public plaza, on the surface of it. So that's the most value is given back to the city context and to the public. So it's more moving when you walk on the roof. It's kind of how you relate back to the city context. You can also have a certain perception to the building itself. So it's kind of going into this onto the carpet that is both building and also big public space. And taking the step further, it's also related to the kind of Nordic set of values. We have a right to roam that is kind of embedded in our culture. That means that we are allowed to access landscape and nature independent from all property rights. So I think we are taking these values into the building and how we deal with the public space itself and how we make it, turn it into public ownership and the issue of openness and unlimited access. I think that's one of the key drivers of this project.
My name is Kjetil Tredal Thorsen. I'm a founding partner of the practice Snøhetta in Oslo. I think we're an international company, really. I mean, yes, we started up in Norway, and some of the background and the thinking maybe comes out of a long-standing social democratic development from a political side, which has influenced our design attitudes, you could say. But in the practice of architecture and design, we're definitely far beyond the borders. We have about 30 different nationalities 200 people, equally amount of men and women, the age differences are there. So I think we're multicultural, multifaceted, international, and at least that's how we like to see ourselves. You know, the political background for opera is that, in the Norwegian context, is that it's a very exclusive kind of art form, which belongs to very few people. And the debate is like 40 years old. It was an art form that belonged to the middle classes or upper classes. Even if you don't believe it, we have those things here. So not only was the content and who the building should actually belong to, but also the debates on location became very evident. I mean, in Oslo, we have the division between the east and the west, where the east of the river is sort of the old working class areas. West of the river is the middle class and upper class and high middle class dwellings. And the city is and has for a long period of time been split. You know, you would find good wives on the west side never crossing the river towards the other side. So by pushing the location of this building, the Opera House, as close to the east side as possible, we were kind of trying to bridge the sort of situation between the east and the west with a high or quite exclusive art form. And we believe that by locating it here, you sort of interrupt slightly the exclusivity of the art form and you focus on the art form rather than on who it belongs to. So we tried to deviate from the normal opinion that opera and ballet didn't have a contemporary relevance. So you have to put it into a contemporary context, and by doing that, you have to challenge the sort of notion of what an opera is and who it's for. And that's what we tried to do.
Do you see yourself and the company playing a leadership or other role in the development of the Norwegian architecture and design scene in the future?
Yes. There is a certain responsibility with through the things that we have done and the sort of position we've landed in after these 30 years of operation, which is demanding on one hand and challenging, but which is part of the responsibility that is laid upon us in this particular sense, and especially as forefront runners when it comes to cultural understanding. I think that's really our main task. But that culture can be everywhere, okay? It can be in your house, in your home, in a school, in a kindergarten, basically everywhere, in your office. I'm trying to describe maybe the responsibility we have to increase quality of life through less obvious materialistic elements, such as like architecture per se. So maybe try to find values that are of a different kind that will turn us into even better people than we are.
While Norway's politicians steer the country beyond the oil boom years, its designers, from the young guns at Klubben to the international powerhouse of Snøhetta, are confidently looking forward to a bright future of spreading their talent across the globe and applying it at home to improve the lives of Norway's citizens. For Monocle, in Oslo, I'm Henry Reece Sheridan.
And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, and the show's prodigious producer, Henry Reece Sheridan. Next week, we remain in Oslo with a special report from the city's architecture triennale, which kicked off last Thursday. If you have any comments or queries, then do feel free to drop Henry a note at hrs@monocle.com. And remember that we're back at the same time next week. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud, or iTunes, and please do leave us a review on the latter. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. Until next time, it's goodbye.